James and Jason McKittrick, brought to you by CryptoCurium.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Learning Lovecraft. I'm your host, Jason McKittrick, and joining me
is Ken James.
Yes, sir. Tonight we are covering what is considered Lovecraft's first story, although canonically there are ones previous. This is considered his first adult story, meaning that this is the one that really was like, okay, here we are, here I am, I am H.P. Lovecraft, here is my first story, and that is The Tomb, written in 1917, but not published until March of 1922. Issue of The Vagrant tells the story of Jervis Dudley, and he gets into a little trouble.
So this being our first numbered episode, the first story, I read, just to give a little insight of how I did it for, you know, our listeners. So I put on some classical music, is what I always found low, which I always find to be the most.
Yeah.
You know,
I like it.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's how I was taught, actually, when I was 11 to read by my fifth grade teacher.
All right.
Mr. Den Sweeney. Thank you, sir. But so I put on some low music. My wife was taking a nap, and so were my dog. So that was perfect for me to just have this alone time, right? To like kind of. And we talked the night before I was, you know, getting ready, and you were like, you know, you have to read them, you know. And there's a lot of people that do the books on tape and things like that. So I got myself. I wanted to get myself in the mode, you know. And I sat there and I was getting myself comfortable. I had the music going, and immediately when I started reading. I don't want to be like, oh, I couldn't put it down, but I was just like, whew.
Yeah.
Whew was the noise, you know? Because, you know, I'm starting this journey, right?
Right.
And I got those jitters to myself, if that makes sense, to when you're starting something completely new from the jump. It's, you know, I know how reveled the works are, and I know how passionate the fans are and how big parts of the lives there are. So I was going in, and as I started reading it, I caught myself going, like, I would get a paragraph and I'd go, wait, hold on. You know, pull myself out, focus. You know, I had to get in there, and I finally, sorry for being a little long-winded about this.
No, please.
But I finally was like, okay, and able to find my stride again, because I haven't read, like, got deep into reading actual works of fiction or any kind of novels in a long time. And when I finally got myself settled in, your words of, you know, you'll start to pick up on the cadence. You'll start to pick up on the style.
Right.
And I had to allow myself to do that, if that makes sense to the people out there.
Yeah.
And I had to restart, no joke, like four times to finally, okay. And the right notes were on, you know, the music in the background.
Yeah.
And I finally, you know, under the light of the Christmas tree, you know, like just...
Sure.
It started to go, and then I started, my senses started to follow along, and I just wanted to say that this being my first, anyone else, this was their first story they read, once you allow yourself to get there, it does pay off.
Yes.
It does pay off, and I have questions, Jay.
Oh, no, and I'm sure that you do, but it's, well, to in response to your little setup there, it's very cool that you did it in the light of the Christmas tree, because you may not be aware, but even though he was a almost militant atheist, he loved Christmas. Loved it. And I think it was more the tradition of things. You'll see when we get into things. He's very much into New England tradition. But that was going to be my first question for you. You just read your first Lovecraft story.
Well, yeah. So my reaction, right, was to immediately text you, and it's like, let's save it.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, so my mind was running. I don't know if we're going to get into this segment yet of my impressions of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so after reading my first one, right, and those who know our other podcast, we've had the wonderful Greg Oliver Bodine narrate a couple stories, and I've had the pleasure of editing them and doing the soundscape for them. Mm-hmm. So I had a kind of a... an idea of the writing and the way the words are said, and words that I don't ever really hear.
Right.
So that was kind of a nice little buffer to go into it to like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But then I found myself, like, some of the words I was like, Like, I'm not a dumb man.
No.
But the some of the words. Oh, and I was telling Jay that, like, so once I was finished my reading, I was like, all right, I'm gonna unwind for the weekend, yeah, get ready for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I'm playing my game. I got my movie on, whatever. And yeah, I kept going.
So it's good to keep in mind that, his style is purposely strange. It was known as a purple style. He would purposely use antiquated words because he wanted to bring you back to an antiquated, older mindset.
Right.
Now, no, there are a lot of times, and yeah, there's definitely been times where, like, what does that word mean? Mm-hmm. But once you get the flow of it, once you get the cadence of what he's saying, it creates this atmosphere, which is which is you know, the goal of a true weird tale is it's all about the atmosphere. Yeah. And once he starts using the way he uses his words, he brings you into the story in a way that's very unique.
And
to Lovecraft.
And if you use the context clues of the word,
Oh,
you
sure.
you'll understand them. Like, but at first you're like, what is that? And then you go, oh wait, okay. And it's all a part of that. It started to make sense halfway through the separation of on to this next part. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes too much sense, but and once again, first timer here, guys. It was you know, the fiction I've always read, you know, whether it be Stephen King, it'd be, you know, The Hatchet, you know, any kind of book or story that, you know, I've ever read. This is wholly different in a way of, like, I want to understand so bad the antiquated language, right? Yeah. But I don't want to step out of it to look it up, right?
Sure.
So, like, you're like, use the context clues to kind of work my way through the sentence, right?
Yeah.
But that makes it all the more better and all the more effective for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
Because I was getting a kind of almost a different language.
Sure. Right? Well, and I think that's the intention because he's and even specifically with this story because of the character, which we're going to get into in a minute, being almost not possessed, but like, so into the past that like you're starting to like pull from the past and you're speaking like someone from a different time.
Right.
I think it's very much purposeful, especially in the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. Yeah. So we, once again, we're talking about The Tomb, you know, written in 1917. And it opens with a quote that I think is pretty spot on, and specifically for Lovecraft, because my name is Jervis Dudley, and from earliest childhood I have been a dreamer and a visionary.
Yeah,
I mean that's a great way to kick it off because that is H.P. Lovecraft. So, but before I go further, I just want to say I'm pulling from both from S.T. Joshi's I Am Providence as well as his H.P. Lovecraft Encyclopedia by him and David E. Schultz.
And I read the version from Eldridge Tales, and that's what I got.
Right. So, what I was mentioning to you when we were texting a little bit, but we become immediately suspicious of his account since he admits to telling it within the confines of an insane asylum.
Right.
But he believes that his story will vindicate him, and his belief that, quote, there is no sharp distinction betwixt the real and the unreal. So,
yeah. So immediately when I read that, right, I did the whole like,
yeah.
So from what I know from you know modern stories and horror, they always do that kind of like,
yeah.
Oh, is it the turning of the screw?
Right,
is it that whole like?
Sure.
Am I gonna get this? Because obviously I'm going into this with the knowledge that most people, a lot of people derive their writings from H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
So I was trying to do the thing, and that's why I had to kind of keep restarting.
Sure.
My mind was turning of going, oh, is this, you know, is this the kind of concept of here and there? Not to interrupt, but yeah, that's I started doing that throughout the story, and that's why I kind of had to keep restarting as well.
Right. So Jervis discovers in a wooded hollow near his home a tomb that houses the remains of a family, the Hydes, which I think is a tip of the hat to Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I think we're, you know, in the realm of, you know, switching bodies, some kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
That dwelt in a mansion nearby. This mansion had been struck by lightning and burned to the ground, although only one member of the family had perished in the flame. The tomb exercises an unholy fascination upon Dudley, and he haunts it for hours at a time. It is locked, but the door is fastened ajar in a queerly sinister way by means of a heavy iron chains and padlocks, according to a gruesome fashion of half a century ago.
Well, there's a question I have, because I thought ajar meant open.
Yeah.
So it's fastened open?
So, okay, so the chains are on there, but loose and open
okay.
just a little bit.
Okay.
So from what I understand, I was looking into this, it's open just up just a little bit to let corpse gases escape.
Okay. Okay, that answers that question, because I was, you know, I understood because he couldn't get in, but I was like, but it's
ajar.
It's
open just a little bit. Okay. So he can, because, you know, when he's looking in and listening.
Yeah.
Okay.
And just for those that are listening, I'm holding on to my copy of the book in a weird way for comfort.
Right. Dudley resolves to enter this tomb at any cost, but he is too young and weak to break open the lock, because he's 10. Beginning of the story.
Right.
Gradually, Dudley begins to display various odd traits, and particularly a knowledge of very ancient things that he could not possibly have learnt from books. One night, as he is lying on the bower outside the tomb, he seems to hear voices from within. Quote, every shade of New England dialect, from the uncouth syllables of the Puritan colonists to the precise rhetoric of 50 years ago, seems represented in that shadowy colloquy.
Mm.
He does not say what the colloquy was about, but upon returning home, he goes directly to a rotting chest in the attic and finds a key to unlock the tomb. This is wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Because
knowledge from beyond the grave.
Yeah, it immediately when I started getting into that portion, that's when I kind of started getting the flow, and the music synced up perfectly.
Beautiful.
You know, my wife was sleeping. It was...
Dudley spends much time in the tomb, but now another peculiar change takes place in him. Hitherto a sequestered recluse, he begins to show signs of ribald revelry as he returns from the tomb. In one instance, he declaims in palpably licorice accents a drinking song of Georgian cast, but one never recorded in a book. He also develops a fear of thunderstorms. Yeah, did you enjoy the little Georgian
I loved
rhyme?
It. I wanted to text you about it, but I was like, don't take me out of where I was.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, how has no one taken this and like put it to? I'm sure someone has, but
I think we just found the person who's gonna.
Yeah, I was like, I think I gotta
do it.
Take this because honestly, it,
yeah.
So there's a quote from Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
Where Scrooge's nephew says,
"Yeah,
you know, I'm just like the my how does he put it? My fellow souls on the journey to the grave."
Yeah,
and he starts talking about reveling while we're here.
Right,
and it was that phrase seems almost like it was that that limerick or whatever you would call it encompassed into a quote.
Right,
and I loved it. I actually loved it because, especially what just happened recently, in my life and going through it, I was like, "Wow,
yeah."
Talk about timely. Talk about something that is from what 19? Would you say 1917?
Yep.
Man, words, and when you put things in the way that he did in that, it's such a macabre beauty. It's hard pressed for me to actually work around it and say just how much I appreciate it.
Oh no, and it's great, and I mean, you know, they're giving you the idea that it's like, okay, well, how could he ever know this?
Yes.
And now you have the idea, okay, well, he's getting some kind of knowledge from the tomb. But if I could read a little bit of it, because it's, you know, come hither, my lads, with your tankards of ale, and drink to the present before it shall fail. Pile each on your platter and a mountain of beef, for 'tis eating and drinking that brings us relief. So fill up your glass, for life will soon pass. When you're dead, you'll never drink to your king or your lass. I mean, it goes on a little bit more, but it's a revel. It's one of those things. It's like, hey, we're here. We're alive.
Can you read the last part, though? Is it there?
The whole thing's here.
Well, read the last part.
The fiends strike me blue. I'm scarce able to walk, and damn me if I can stand up right or talk. Here, landlord, bid Betty to summon a chair. I'll try home for a while, for my wife is not there. So lend me a hand, I'm not able to stand, but I'm gay whilst I linger on top of the land. Yeah.
I love that. I'm happy whilst I linger on top of the land.
Yeah.
And that's the whole, me and my fellow souls will enjoy this time while we're on our journey to the grave.
Yeah. And it's very much in keeping with this, you know, I think Lovecraft's personal ideas, but it's, you know, you're here. We're here. Let's enjoy this time. I mean, here we are. We're drinking. We're having a great time. Whatever yesterday was, whatever tomorrow is, let's, you know, we're here. We might as well enjoy it.
And it was this break in the story, right? It was like, right, I think it's almost the middle where, you know, you were reading all this thing about this fascination, and all of a sudden comes this this song.
Yeah.
And it was just like, and then it goes right back in away. You know what I mean? Yeah. And obviously it was an intentional point in there, but I loved that. I absolutely loved that. And that, as far as the story goes, that, that was top three favorite parts.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because he, the drinking song, was actually written separately years before, they think. It was something that he came up with, because Lovecraft, before he was, before his, you know, writing of fiction, he was, he wanted to be a poet. So he was getting into the poetry, and this was one of his original, you know,
pieces.
One of his original pieces, but done in the Georgian style, because he was very much, very much enamored with that time, that time period. But yeah, it was a previously written thing that he had added, and, which is something he, he did do from time to time, but yeah. So you know, he's spending this time, you know, from in the tomb, and he's coming back with this, like, you know, seemingly like, how would he have this knowledge, you know, kind of thing going on. So his parents become increasingly worried about his odd behavior. They hire a spy to follow him. Right. On one occasion, Dudley thinks that the spy has seen him coming out of the tomb, but the spy tells his parents that Dudley had spent the night on the bower outside the tomb. Dudley, now convinced that he is under some sort of supernatural protection, frequents the tomb without fear of circumspection. Yeah. One night, as thunder is in the air, he goes to the tomb and sees the mansion as it was in its heyday. You know, he has this vision, right? A party is underway, and guests in powdered wigs are brought in by carriage, but a peal of thunder interrupts this swinish revelry, and a fire breaks out. Dudley flees, but finds himself being restrained by two men. So he's at this party, and I guess he sees himself in the party, remember?
Right, yeah, but before that, he says how he's terribly afraid of thunder.
Right.
And the electric from the sky.
Right.
And that was prior to this, and leading up to this,
yeah,
his whole, like, he almost has this supernatural...
Yeah.
You know, now, like, protection under him. Mm-hmm. So even his holy fear of the lightning,
right?
You know, it's gone now, and he has this vision of the party.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to add that in.
No, it's his fear of it is interesting, and I also like this quote. I should not have ventured out that night, for the taint of thunder was in the clouds, and a hellish phosphorescence rose from the rank swamp at the bottom of the hollow.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so he, you know, he's at this party, and he's completely just, you know, throwing all caution.
Oh, yeah, it's revelry.
But among, and they even say, among all the revelers, he was the most, you know, the most crazy. He
cantankerous.
Was the, yeah, sure. So he says, amidst a wild and reckless throng, I was the wildest and most abandoned. Gay blasphemy poured in torrents from my lips, and in shocking sallies, I heeded no law of God, man, or nature.
It was just a force that night. You know?
Oh yeah, man. He was.
It was like, I'm home. I'll be damned. Like, I'm here.
Right.
And all sorts of happy blasphemy. Like, I don't care about this and that. I'm having a good time.
Yep. So then he imagines this, you know, or has the vision of that thunderbolt coming through, right? Mm-hmm. And a fire breaks out. So he flees, but then he finds himself being restrained by the two men, right?
Yeah.
They maintain that Dudley had spent the entire night outside the tomb and point to the rusted and unopened lock as evidence. Dudley is put away in the madhouse. A servant for whom I bore a fondness in infancy goes to the tomb and breaks it open and finds a porcelain miniature with the initials J.H. The picture could be of Dudley's twin. And then on a slab in an alcove, he found an old but empty coffin, old but empty, whose tarnished plate bears the single word Jervis. In that coffin and in that vault, they have promised me I shall be buried.
Right.
So, yeah, so I know you had, you know, you wanted, what did you think?
Right, okay, so there's a couple things they left out. So in his journeys to finally getting in there when he was older, I think he was 21 when he finally was able to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes in, he gets into this tomb, but one of the big things that I started getting the atmospherics of it all was when he's talking about the smells, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he saw some of the visuals of some things that he didn't, he was like, that was never my concern, but... The smells and the voices he was hearing, there's his description. I'm not going to quote it, but it's basically like if you've ever been to any kind of old building where it's stone, mm-hmm. and the rain, which would eventually cast mud up and dirt uh-huh. onto the brick, yeah. and it dries, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. But then on moist nights, it has this distinct
right.
smell because not just it's not just like, oh, that's a smell. When our nostrils are actually moisturized, that's how things really smell.
Okay,
And that's just science. But I get it and I know it because like you'll be that rain when it starts to kind of rain and you get the smell of the concrete or you get the smell of like you know you're like I know that smell. So right. when he was talking about the mud on the rocks, and
yeah,
all this,
yeah,
it went right into my memory,
yeah.
and it went right to I was like I know where he is,
yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? Because I've been in the woods when it's been wet, like yeah. found old structures and
sure.
stuff, and like it drew me. The writing style is there's a lot of workarounds to get yourself to that point where you're like, okay, I know this sense that he's trying to put me in. But yeah, so that was the one thing I said. But the thing is, him going there, they also said that the one of the spies was like, you never went in. Like,
right.
yeah, you never went in. You right. were just sleeping outside of it the whole time.
Right.
And but he had the knowledge of the two, and he would go lay.
Right.
He found himself fascinated with the idea of laying in that coffin.
Right.
That his name was eventually known, Jervis was
yeah.
Inscribed on.
Yeah.
So, like, okay. So, my first text to Jay was, so is he reincarnated as one of these hides?
Well, or? I think that's the question you're left with.
Yeah, right. Or in some dream space of escapism, did he, I don't know, have an out-of-body experience, travel in the past to become a part of this family at some point,
yeah, yeah.
and they left him an empty coffin because he was so fun that one night.
Maybe.
You know, maybe. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So, but the servant of the family that he was really fond of,
yeah.
that was like, he can't be crazy. I know this guy too well.
Yeah.
To go in and break in and find, like, no, this is the yeah. coffin he's been talking about, and it's got his name on it.
Yeah.
And we found this likeness of him.
Yeah, it's a little portrait.
So this family was obviously fond of him.
Yeah.
And left him a spot there.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, you're not the only one who questioned that, because that's
okay.
That's the question that you're left with.
Right.
That's what you're... Okay, so what did I... Did he? So, okay, so the tomb, as it turns out, it's anomalous in Lovecraft's work for a variety of reasons. So, in the first place, there's some doubt as to whether the horror is external or internal. Supernatural or psychological. Is Jervis Dudley possessed by the spirit of his ancestor and lookalike Jervis Hyde, or has he imagined the entire thing? So... Most people will go for the supernatural explanation because he has the possession of that knowledge, right? So there's the part where he's talking about not only the song where he comes back with, but the
yeah.
part where he has knowledge where it was the guy, was it Squire Brewster, who was he was buried, but they knew that he turned over twice in his grave.
Yeah.
And they stole his clothes.
Yeah.
Like, how do you have that knowledge?
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean?
I forgot about that part. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, you know, yeah. a little buried alive story.
Yeah.
So he has that plus the little, I mean, yeah, if you were obsessed with that age, you could have written the little, you know, the little poem, the little,
yeah.
The little revel, whatever the correct word for it is. But the fact that he has that weird knowledge of that burial, it just, you kind of have to go to supernatural because... How else would he have that knowledge?
Well, especially since anyone that was spying on him and watching
yeah.
said he never went in.
Right.
But he was laying in that yeah. coffin every night.
Yeah.
You know? So, it's like, was he falling asleep or was he dream? Like, was his, like,
yes.
spirit walking in? Was it an out-of-body experience?
I would... I mean, yeah, those are the questions that are there for you. That's,
sure. Yeah.
That's the whole, you know, you're
yeah.
giving this, he's giving
right,
you this
right.
thing to chew on at the
right.
end. There's also a quote where he says, on one occasion, I startled a villager by leading him confidently to a shallow sub-cellar of whose existence I seemed to know in spite of the fact that it had been unseen and forgotten for many generations. Another example.
Yeah.
Joshi in I Am Providence seems to think the same, because he says the fundamental idea is that the spirit of Jervis Hyde, who was burned to death in the fire that consumed his house, has reached across the centuries to seize a body who will at last fill his empty coffin in the tomb of the Hydes.
Right.
So that cleansing bolt of lightning, it's kind of a shtick, but it's definitely something that's used, and we'll see it in another story. But it's almost like he was, you know, having this crazy party the one night. He's the one the most godless, yeah, the most revelous, and he's the only one that gets hit by the lightning. So if you're hit by lightning that direct, was he just like vaporized? Let's say he was.
Well, yeah.
So there was no one to occupy his tomb. So
I think that lends itself to the randomness of lightning, how they say lightning never strikes twice, right?
Uh-huh.
So the fact that it struck him there on that night, whatever happened to him, and then, you know, the cleansing strike and everything, I think that might be the whole, like, also concept of how randomness and the people that find themselves amidst the randomness, being a part of it, being like that, you know, 300 billion to one kind of situation, where just maybe he is, like, you know, the soul, you know, the body in there. Yeah. I think that is a little kind of a little spicy thing in there.
Sure.
Another little thing that you're like, it's another thing to think of, because, like, I have so many thoughts running through and I'm trying to, like, pull them out. But I think that, like, those coincidence of those nights,
it's
that.
Yeah.
When is this ever going to happen again?
Yeah. Right.
But those things happen. You know, like, that's the kind of thing.
I like that it has all this openness to it, because then also there's, you know, and I think we can count you and I among these types of folks where it's like you get into some of this stuff and it's like you can, I'll use the word obsessed, you can become obsessed with things and, like, you almost feel like you become part of those things that are so far removed from you in time that it's like, you can't really explain it, but you kind of, like, oh, you kind of see kinship in those types of people.
Yeah.
And it's like, and, you know, this dude was spending time in graveyards and
from 10 to 21, right?
Dude, I've spent quite a few times in my life in graveyards and wandering through graveyards, and it's beyond interesting. Clearly this story is a meditation on death and what that means and and it's just
it also gives you when you said the questions that you're left asking.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, with it being a meditation on death, you know, he gives you that nice little poem of acceptance and like kind of like enjoying why you're here, but then it quick breaks back to, like, but here I was, you know.
Right.
Back in my, I guess, corporeal form. I don't know if that's the right thing to say there, but he's back in that, you know, essence of his obsession, where he's having these faint, I guess, memories or recollection of who he was, because he's getting this knowledge from the other side.
Yeah.
And he almost gets to the point where, like, he actually felt like himself again, because he was saying in the beginning how I've always been odd and weird, and, like, the people in the towns have always, like, oh, they whisper about me and all this stuff. But then he gets to the point where he's like, fuck it.
You're good.
You know, but, like, you know, he gets to the point where he's like, I'm going to be me. This is really me.
Yeah.
And then it turns out in that vision, it really was him.
Sure.
You know? So, like, that whole, like, it's not just a meditation on death. It's also a meditation on there is something else. You know, it's like that hope in the darkness kind of deal.
Yes, but then Lovecraft also inserts the thing that we said in the beginning, that he's saying it from a mental institution.
Exactly.
So what are we even to think? Because he might be so deluded at this point that what he's telling us, half that didn't even happen.
Right, because he even said, too, he said in the beginning, too, he's like, what's real and what's not, there is this fine break in what is real and what isn't.
Yes.
So, like, you're left with, you know...
There is no sharp distinction betwixt the real and the unreal.
Exactly. Right there. Yeah. Right. And it's so true. Because even, you know, with our other stuff. But, like, that's the thing. So, like, it was honestly like the perfect story to start me down this road, because so many concepts I've dealt with and the obsession, like you said, with these sort of things, and, like, you kind of, like, he's kind of in search of these answers, but also he's in search of, like, an acceptance, but not from the people around him.
Yeah.
Because he's wealthy, he doesn't care, his parents, you know, all this stuff, he doesn't care.
He's got a lot of free time.
Right. But also, he cares a little bit, because he just doesn't want his parents to understand, until he gets to the point where he doesn't care.
Right.
And at that point, then he's himself, right?
Right, because that's, and then he's able to party and let go, yeah. And he seems to almost like, if there were these two, let's say, time where these two spheres that come together, right. Comes together at that point where right. He like has that, you know,
yeah.
You know, his spewing gay blasphemies, right. And, you know, whatever, yeah. You know, whatever it said, that's when he's most, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's when he feels like he's most in touch with his, if it's this past self or this, if you view it that way, or if you view it as like, you know, some kind of whatever, but you know, it's his self that he's kind of like invented for himself. He's invented right. What this, you know, this Jervis Hyde was like. Oh, I think this is what happened. Like, yeah. They don't know the story. He just knows that it burned down. Yeah. But in mind, oh, there was a bolt of lightning because he got right. Too crazy. Like,
yeah. And he's always been so scared of it. Yeah. And like, and that's once again, like I said, with the whole one in a 3 billion.
Yeah.
Like, maybe this is all a guess, but it struck true. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And once again, that lends itself to the lightning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it lends itself to that, like...
Yeah. There's enough to say yes, but there's also enough to say no.
Right.
And that's what makes it fun.
And it was, yeah. It's good. It's actually, and it was definitely being my first actual, when I sat down and read.
Yeah.
I was glad it was this one. Like, I had that moment of
I'm glad you liked it. I mean, there's, this is, you know, this is very much one of his Poe stories, quote unquote. It's definitely got the influence of Poe on it. I mean, certain folks have certainly said that it's way too borrowing of Poe. To pull here a little bit from Joshi again. In spite of any borrowings from Poe, The Tomb is an admirable piece of work for a 27-year-old who had not written a line of fiction in 9 years.
He was 27 when he wrote this.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
It's good. Well, I have a movie that I know.
Yeah.
This influence. Okay. Did you ever see The Straitjacket with Adrian Brody?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where him laying in that, he has to go back, and it sends him through different points of time.
The concepts of, you know, going to a past self or a past self on a different timeline or a type of self in a different way, this is something we're going to come back to a lot.
Sure.
I'm not specifically, I don't know. Yes, it could have influenced that. I don't know how original this concept of a past self or seeing yourself as a past self. I can't say how original this is to Lovecraft himself, but it's certainly something we're going to come back to.
It's just something that reminded me of, because like talking about this, I haven't thought about that movie, and
I can't
tell you how long.
Yeah.
And just sitting here while we were talking about it, that's when it like came back. I'm like, where have I seen this concept?
Yeah.
And it was there. The obsession, having to go back into the grave. Being this point, it had to be a straitjacket into a morgue.
Yeah,
you know, it rang true to me there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's one of the components we're interested in here. Like,
yes.
I like that, you know, you read the story and then you're immediately like, oh, that reminded me of that, and that's cool because that's going to happen a lot.
Right.
So, just a little background on this story. I just thought it was really interesting. So this. Story was inspired by a walk through Swan Point Cemetery that Lovecraft had in June of 1917. Lovecraft says, In 1917, I was walking through Swan Point Cemetery with my aunt and saw a crumbling tombstone with a skull and crossbones dimly traced upon its slaty surface. Excuse me. The date, 1711, still plainly visible. It set me thinking. Here was a link with my favorite era of periwigs, the body of a man who had worn a full-bottomed wig and had perhaps read the original sheets of The Spectator. Here lay a man who lived in Mr. Addison's day and who might easily have been Mr. Dryden had he been in the right part of London or at that right time. Why could I not talk with him and enter more intimately into the life of my chosen age? What had left his body and that could no longer converse with me? I looked long at that grave, and the night after I returned home, I began my first story of the new series, The Tomb. So, the tomb that he saw was a distant relative of his Aunt Lillian, Simon Smith, 1662 to 1711. So, took that walk in the cemetery. Sees this grave of a distant relative, and I guess that gets you going. Like, you know, died in 1711. Wow.
I liked when he said, "What has left his body that I cannot converse with him?" That see, those are the kind of philosophical questions that, that like just in my own head I get.
Yeah.
And once again, I want to say I'm not a dumb man, but you know, I chatter amongst myself in my head an awful lot, and it's it's so funny to know that, like, you know, someone of this renown that would have that, like, their mind goes down the same spirals, you know, as yours does. When you see something and you start asking these questions, it's just the medium's different, right?
Yeah.
You know, his is in that way. Mine, most of the time, it gets taken out on the paddle, you know, in video games, you know, like, it's just like, I don't know. I don't know. And I mean, writing and music and stuff like that, but anymore, it's just that question, what has left his body that I cannot converse with him?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
And, you know, I guess neither did he, but, you know, it's certainly something he was pondering, and it's
heir apparent in the tale of the tomb.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, I think that I think we've tread the ground around the tomb enough. I think we've got a good understanding, and I'm glad that we've got our first story under our belts.
I love the idea of that you saying that we got our understanding of it, when in reality there's just questions.
Yeah.
The questions are the understanding, right?
Sure. Yeah, because that could be the thing that you're going to be chewing on for a while.
Yeah. It's just like, what actually happened?
Yeah.
What actually happened in the story? And you're like...
And I think any of the interpretations is
choose your
is
adventure
okay.
at this point. You know,
yes,
like,
100%.
Right. And I like that too. I like that to come to your own conclusion.
Yeah.
Nothing's definitive.
Yeah.
Was he crazy? Was he not? And that can just send you in your own writing journey in your head of coming up with a good. What was the conclusion of it?
Yeah, maybe I want to go sit by a tomb for the next,
you
know, 11 years or whatever it was.
I'm going reincarnation.
Okay.
Cool. Somewhere in the time the lightning strike. That's what I like. That was my interpretation when I read it.
I think it's like both. You know what I mean? I think it's like I think it's both. I think maybe it was like there was some kind of weird spiritual whatever you want to, you know, some kind of transference thing going on, but I think it also drove him crazy.
Right. I wasn't.
You know what I mean? Like it is and it isn't. Like
it's
either answer works. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Almost had a stroke there. So. Well.
All right.
I loved it.
So, for this evening's edition of Learning Lovecraft, I've been Jason McKittrick.
And I've been Ken James.
And we'll see you on the other side of sleep.